This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the book titled Another Tucson, written by Bonnie Henry and published in 1992. This chapter is entitled That's Entertainment, Article Number 12, The Lyric Theater. Nuns and street thug kids, and your grandma, and once, just once, a woman who swam, along with Esther Williams. These were the folks who filled up that squatty box of a theater known as the Lyric. Other theaters may have gotten Hoppy or Gable first, but the Lyric second-run house surely loved them best. The kids would get so excited watching those westerns that they'd start cutting up the seats. So we'd say, give us your knives and pop guns. Then we'd give them back at the end of the show, recalls George N. Diamos, a second-generation member of the family that built and operated the Lyric Theater on West Congress Street. By the time Ewart Edwards, who now manages the De Anza and Apache drive-ins, signed on as a teenage doorman in the spring of 51, the Lyric had been for some time as an uptown visit as it would ever be. Sound, air conditioning, and snack bar, all squeezed into a short, fat box. It held 751 seats, says Edwards, who would soon become assistant manager and then manager of the Lyric for most of the 50s. The balcony was cramped, hard wooden seats, no loge, plush seats downstairs. The lobby was small, small restrooms. It was a cramped situation, but cheap. We had the movie Overrun, Edwards explains. Movies played the Paramount, the Fox, the Catalina, all first-run houses. Then they came to the Lyric. So did the audiences. Best days were Sundays, said Edwards. I'd get there and there would already be a line. We'd sell out for one show, and there would be lines for the next. Capitalizing on that somewhat captive sidewalk audience was a small cafe down the street, Sally and Sam's. They'd bring their popcorn machine to the front door when our lines were waiting outside, said Edwards. Then they'd sell their popcorn to our customers. Once past the cashier, customers found a staff of, oh, a dozen or so, all properly attired in gray and maroon. In the evenings, the manager and assistant manager were on the floor in tuxedos, Edwards adds. Even more impressive than all this snappy dressing were the performances behind the snack bar. The first thing you learned was how to pour soda, said Edwards. They were still using bottles. You lined up the cups with ice, opened the bottles, held four of them between your fingers, flipped your hands over, and poured. Some guys could do five at a time. At least once, however, all that efficiency dribbled down the drain. We had a picture that appealed to the Mormon community. It sold out, Edwards recalls. It was a long show with a built-in intermission. Because our snack bar was so small, we poured several hundred cola drinks. Mormons didn't drink cola. We ended up throwing it out. Religion up on the screen usually meant like-minded souls down in the audience. We had lots of tie-ins with the Catholic school, said Edwards. We'd have a 10 a.m. show, invite the nuns and their students. Piety, however, was often more the exception than the rule at the Lyric. We'd show some controversial films, French, Two Prints. We'd always start with a risque version, said Edwards. If an official or someone in the public complained, then we'd go with the backup. But no one complained. Steamy pictures often warranted. What else? Your typical fried egg on the sidewalk promotion. For Elmer Gantry, however, the Lyric tried the opposite tack. We used a 100-pound cake of ice, says Edwards. Giant movie posters covered with sealer were sometimes slathered on the sidewalk in front of the marquee. They would last for days while people walked on them and noticed the show, said Edwards. But if it rained, it got slippery, and we had to take them up. The Lyric, like just about every other theater in town, was still segregated in the early 50s. We could only sell tickets to blacks for the balcony, said Edwards. That practice, he adds, ended in 1954. CinemaScope came to the Lyric in the winter of 54 to 55. We were down 2 days, said Edwards. All we did was stick the screen in front of the old one and knock out the small stage. The orchestra pit was already boarded up. The Robe was the first to go widescreen at the Lyric. Later, the theater would also boast a bilingual version of the Ten Commandments. About a year after we played it in English, it came back with Spanish subtitles, said Edwards. But it didn't do that well. Despite its second-run status, the Lyric operated under the same rules as its uptown Fox Tucson neighbors, says Edwards. We had to keep the graffiti off the restroom walls. Women would use lipstick, and you couldn't get it off. We used to paint the ladies' restroom once a week. Then we discovered a rose-colored paint that didn't show the lipstick so much. They quit writing on the walls. Of all the hand-holding, popcorn-throwing sagas to come out of the Lyric during the 50s, few can match Edward's story of a lady who swam on dry land, in this case down the middle of a movie aisle. It was a Sunday afternoon. We were full, as usual. An usher came running out and said people were climbing all over each other, screaming and hollering. We brought up the house lights. I walked down to the front of the theater. We had an Esther Williams show on. There was this lady, lying in the aisle, staring up at the screen, and she was swimming on the floor. I lightly tapped her on the shoulder. She looked like she was in a trance. I asked her if she was all right. She looked around, said she was perfectly all right. Then she noticed the circle of people around her and asked, "Why are all these people staring at me?" Then she got up, got her purse in the seat where she left it, and walked up the aisle with me to the lobby. She went into the bathroom. After a while, she came out and left. She was an older woman, well-dressed. I never saw her again. A fire in the early morning hours shut down the snack bar, but not the movie house itself during the 50s. "Someone left the popcorn machine on," said Edwards. So we brought in popcorn already popped from the Fox. Less resilient was the theater's adjustment to changing times. By the late 50s, people who used to come downtown in the evenings weren't coming down anymore, said Edwards, who left to become manager of the Fox Tucson in 1959. In later years, says Edwards, off-duty policemen doubled as security guards at the old theater. In the summer of 66, the theater that gave us everything from Mexican vaudeville to Brigitte Bardot was reduced to rubble to make way for a new county building. 7 months later, comedy and pathos had combined for one final and somewhat fitting film, Laurel and Hardy and the Roaring Twenties, along with the co-feature, Old Yeller. Article number 13, Plaza Theater. Amateurs giggled on stage, professionals emoted on screen, and a future world-famous artist earned his keep out in the lobby. Oh yeah, the chili dogs weren't bad either. Where else but the Plaza? As with most tales of this ilk, it began with great fanfare, ended with a thud. Merchant Aaron Kaufman was the builder and owner as of July 3, 1930, the grand opening date for West Congress Street's newest movie house. Designed by Roy Place, architect of countless Tucson landmarks, including the old Pima County Courthouse, the plaza boasted seats for 650, Vitaphone sound, and according to that day's star, refreshing breezes 10 to 15 degrees lower than street temperature. A street fair featuring jazz band music, bathing beauties, most attractive child contestants, and Negro minstrels lured the crowds on opening day. Inside, five usherettes dressed in Sunday frocks and sporting flowers in their hair showed patrons to their seats. A Royal Romance was the plaza's first show, paired with a newsreel, Warner Brothers cartoon, and the all-Spanish talking, singing, and dancing of Paulo, Paquita, and Chiquita. It was not enough. Within months, the theater was under new ownership, the DeAimos family, who ran a string of movie houses around the state. They remodeled, put in a foyer, added a better sound system. With the birth of several Spanish-language film companies during the 30s, the time was now ripe. The plaza had found its niche. Spanish-language movies when available, American movies the rest of the time. Still, the hard times ground on. I remember one day in the summer when we took in $6.20 for the whole day, says George N. DeAimos, who worked at the plaza for a time. Not long after the DeAimos family took over, the plaza discovered the value of live entertainment. a tradition that continued until its final days. There were some young kids with guitars who played the little bars in town. They called themselves the Carlista Brothers, said DeAlmos. We booked them for $15 for 2 days, 3 performances a day. Then we had to go to $25. They went big time. But not as big time as a young man who managed the plaza during the mid-30s, artist Ted DeGrazia, who was once married to Alejandra DeAlmos, sister of George N. 3 decades later, DeGrazia would tell a Star reporter that it was the movies at the plaza which sparked my visit to Mexico City and no doubt later influenced my paintings. Other eras, other owners. By the early 60s, the movie house had changed hands again after plaza manager Abe Campiello took over the business, along with partners Jesus Granilla and Albert Campiello, Abe's brother. By then, the plaza was running Spanish-language movies exclusively, although the cartoons were still in English. The plaza showed first-run Mexican movies, said Campiello. Then they wound up at the Fiesta drive-in. Still going strong at the plaza was the lineup on stage. That was our pride and joy, says Campiello. At that time, Mexican movie stars had no place to go. They toured the States, and when they did, they'd come here. At least once a month, we'd have the live shows. You could get maybe 30 out on that stage, adds Campiello, as the names trip off his tongue. Pedro Infante, Javier Solas, Liberata Lamarck. We also had Tintan and Carnal Marcelo. They were the Abbott and Costello of Mexico. Out went the flyers on the street. On went the commercials on the Spanish-language radio stations. Admission was about $3, admits Campiello. You got a 45-minute performance, plus the movies. We sold out all the time. Though the plaza screen was wide enough for CinemaScope, says Campiello, that form seldom, if ever, appeared at the plaza. Very few Mexican movies were made in CinemaScope, he explains. Cooled by the swamp box till its last day, the plaza opened for business 7 days a week. Weekends were the busiest. It was always a family theater, says Campiello. There was a sort of magic on West Congress Street. You'd go to the movies, go to a restaurant afterward, walk up and down the street. We never had any problems. Plaza patrons could also enjoy more filling fare than a box of Milk Duds. We sold chili dogs, hot dogs, and submarine sandwiches, says Campiello. Open to the street, the plaza snack bar served the non-moving-going public as well. Though the plaza had its fill of bona fide stars, no one drew them to the plaza like the homegrown hams. Every Thursday was amateur night, says Campiello. 98% were singers. Some who sang at the plaza went on to fame, but most found the spotlight fleeting at best. People used to razz the acts. They would laugh, says Campiello. We had no gong, no hook, but we did have finalists and winners. Everybody wanted to try out at the plaza. Master of Duties fell on the shoulders of the late Lorenzo C. Palma, a local radio announcer. He was one in a million, says Campiello. He was comical, he had a beautiful voice, he could sing, make the people laugh. He did the auditioning for the shows, and if someone didn't show up to perform, he would grab someone from the audience. Ah, the still golden years, when all did their shopping and recreating downtown. Theaters were the magnet, said Campiello. They brought everybody downtown. And then, one by one, downtown's marquee lights started blinking out. The plaza was one of the last, falling to urban renewal in 1969. The last 2 years, business was pretty bad, said Campiello. People started moving out. The city let things go to justify tearing it down. His pleas to officials fell on deaf ears. I asked if we could have a Mexican theater somewhere else. They said it did not fall in with their plans. Before the auctioners moved in, one last despatio, or fell wall party, was held at the little movie house down on West Congress Street. And then the wrecking ball had its way. Article 14. Hispanic Social Clubs. They dressed to the nines, swayed to the rhythms on the dance floor, even put on plays. Forget that old wine, first uttered, no doubt, back when Geronimo was still a pup, that there's nothing for kids to do in this town. These kids made their own fun. Club Mavis, Club Esmeralda, El Centro, Monte Carlo, the Gaylords, those are just some of the dozen or so social clubs that thrived in Tucson during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. All shared some common threads. Members, for the most part, were young, unmarried, Hispanic, and Tucson High School educated. All are also history, though several have spun off into new clubs using the original membership lists. Of all the clubs, El Centro, a boys' club that thrived during the 30s, had perhaps the most exalted membership requirements, at least in the beginning. "We were all altar boys at Santa Cruz Church," says Oscar Montano, an early member of the club. Brother Angel from the Carmelite Order at Santa Cruz started the club. Begun with a handful of the boys, the club quickly swelled to about 60 members, more than enough to field its own baseball team. "In the late 30s, we built a clubhouse on the church grounds," Montano says. "Easter Sunday was the club's biggest day of the year. We all dressed in white pants, dark coats, and marched together down the aisle of the church for Mass," says Montano. "That evening, we held a banquet and invited dates. We dressed all in white, and the girls all wore long dresses." The club also put on plays in the Safford School Auditorium, and at least once on the road. Our most famous play, Maria Nella, played twice in Tucson, once in Superior, says Montano, former leading man. By the end of the 40s, says Montano, the club was no more. Once the older boys got to a marrying age, it started going out of existence. The end of the 40s, however, was just the beginning for Club Mavis, an all-girl club made up of mostly THS juniors and seniors. "We were all girls from the same neighborhood. We all grew up together, went to school together," says Evelina Socorras DuPont, one of the club's founding members. Meetings were held weekly in their parents' homes. "We had to hold the membership to 23 because no one's home could accommodate more," said DuPont. This was a club known for its dances, most of them fundraisers. "Dances was what we seemed to do best," says DuPont, whose father, Ray Siqueiros, was a founding owner of El Casino Ballroom. "If there was a Club Mavis dance, everyone wanted to go. Springtimes, the club held its Ball de los Consaros. We made thousands of eggs," says DuPont. "We had confetti in the carpet for months." Louis Leon or Wayne Webb led their orchestras at many of the Club Mavis dances. "Big band and Latin music," remembers DuPont. Each January, the girls swirled through the club's anniversary formal, held in the ballrooms of a pioneer or El Conquistador. "We wore long gowns and tuxes for those," says DuPont. One of the club's more memorable dances, however, was spur of the moment, held on the eve of the Korean War. "The night before a bunch of the boys were being shipped out, we went to the Naval Reserve and the other military places and put up posters advertising a dance at El Casino. Then we asked all the girls of the various clubs to come. It was a big, free dance to send off all those boys. We didn't know if 20 would show up or 200. It was packed, and all the girls came," said DuPont. In 1955, Evelina Soros married Martin DuPont. Not long after, she organized Club Duet, made up of former Club Mavis members. Club Mavis, however, is no more. It held its last dance in 1972. When the boys came home from Korea, some of them formed their own social club, Monte Carlo, which lasted from approximately the mid-50s to the mid-60s. Just about all the members, who numbered about 30, were unmarried and in their 20s. Most of us had gone to Tucson High, gone into the military, and then enrolled in the University of Arizona, said Mike Perez, who became a Monte Carlo member in 1954. "We had our clubhouse in the old Allianz building on Congress Street," he adds. Many of the club's activities centered on benefit dances for various charities. After graduation, however, most of the members pursued their professional lives, either here or out of town, and the club gradually died out. Yet another once prominent social club in this town was the 20 Teens. It was a terrific group of about 20 girls, says Susie Arallo, who joined 20 Teens in 1941 as a THS co-ed. It started with girls around 13, but then as they got older, it went into their 20s. Members met every Sunday after Mass in each other's homes, says Arallo. They, too, were known for their famous dances at the Blue Moon, at Wetmore's, at El Casino. We always gave a sunrise dance on Christmas Eve after midnight Mass to 6 a.m., says Arallo. We had big band music, short dresses for us, coat and tie for the fellas. In those days, you dressed up. The club also visited the Veterans Hospital and made Christmas baskets for the poor. We'd get a list from the school, says Arallo. Once a 20-teen married, she went into an auxiliary club, Arco Iris, which is still around, says Arallo. The club that started it all, however, is no more. 20 Teens called it quits in the 70s, says Arallo. Angie Aragon will always remember her initiation into Club Esmeralda, another social club that began in the late 40s. They dressed us in long johns and diapers and took us to a dance hall on St. Mary's Road. There were 10 of us. We had to get out on the dance floor and dance among ourselves. The sight of 10 teenage girls in diapers hardly raised an eyebrow. That was a normal thing back then. Like Evelina DuPont, Aragon also married in 1955 and promptly started another club for married former Esmeraldos. Club Ruby, as it was named, is still going strong, she reports, though it has become a couples club. As for Club Esmeralda, says Yagan, it was already fading out by the late 50s. Those years, however, were prime for the Gaylords, a young men's social club that went full bore from the mid-50s into the 60s. It started in 1956, says Robert Bourbon, Yongarn's younger brother who became a Gaylord in 1957. Most members were in their late teens, early 20s. At one time, we had 45 members, says Bourbon. Meetings came once a week. We started in each other's homes. Then we all chipped in and built ourselves a clubhouse, says Bourbon. There was no Our Gang clubhouse. We bought the lot for about $3,000 and put up the house for about $7,000, Bourbon remembers. The Gaylords worked the booths at various fiestas, sold raffle tickets, and also held dances at El Casino and Del Rio Ballroom. Name of their favorite band? The Ramblers. Rock and roll, says Bourbon. In the early 70s, the Gaylords dissolved. We just started having different interests, says Bourbon. The clubhouse quickly sold. We built it as a three-bedroom house, says Bourbon. It's still there. Article number 6, Junior Assembly. Some still speak of it with a shudder. For two generations, pubescent boys and girls from Tucson's proper families spent their Saturday afternoons learning the waltz, the rumba, and their how-do-you-dos in a little exercise known as Junior Assembly. You dressed like you were going to Sunday school, said Jim Turner, who attended Junior Assembly from grades 6 through 9. Held for years at the Tucson Women's Club downtown, the dance and department lessons were by invitation only. You had to have the right connection, said Turner, who would later work at the University of Arizona. The grand onion of this was Isabel Drachman, who for 28 years ruled Junior Assembly with a stern look, an authoritative voice, and a pair of killer stilettos. She would stalk across the dance floor in those high heels, said Lynn Harris, another Junior Assembly alum from the early 60s. Naturally, there was an enforcer. Mrs. Drachman hired the head usher from the Fox Theater to holler at us and get us in line, said Turner. He was tall and skinny and had a Duane Eddy hairstyle. All the boys and girls, said Turner, were coupled up to enter the wood-floored ballroom via a serpentine march. At the north end of the room was a piano, held down, said Turner, by a blank-faced old man pounding out On Wisconsin, Buckle Down, Winsocky, and other inspirational marching songs. Ethel Fritchie, who for years ran a dance studio here, taught the children all the right moves, including the waltz, foxtrot, and cha-cha-cha. Boys did the asking, said Turner, except during holiday parties when featured ladies' choice. In between dance lessons, Strachman expounded on proper etiquette. At least three times every Saturday she would interrupt her lectures to remind the girls to keep their knees together, said Harris. Meanwhile, boys would be boys. Turner remembered how he and a few other culprits stuck toy caps under their heels, which exploded when they stepped on the dance floor's metal heater gratings. A generation earlier, it was chickens stolen from the UA farm and let loose in the ballroom. Class was called off for fear someone would slip on you-know-what, said Ruth Corbett Cross, whose junior assembly training harks back to its beginning years in the late 30s. Cross, mother to Lynn Harris, remembered classes held in a variety of venues, taught by predecessors to Drachman. The winning formula was already in place. Sunday best clothes, an old man pounding the piano, and sweaty palms. We learned the two-step, the rumba, and the tango, said Cross, but no dipping. Deportment lessons came in 5-minute blasts, said Cross, followed by punch and cookies served by the boys. Even so, Cross finagled her way free after 4 years. I finally convinced my father I wouldn't be good on the athletic field if I did this every Saturday afternoon. Yet she still insisted her daughter attend. I felt it did me good, said Cross. In 1973, Drachman died of cancer. Junior Assembly, with others at the helm, carried on until the mid-80s. Similar purveyors of propriety, such as Desert Juniors, also stepped in. But for many a Tucsonian, it will always be Junior Assembly that taught them the intricacies of the receiving line, the rumba, and how to sit like a lady. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.